Thank you. Let's have the parties start their videos and we will begin.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. With Judges Ross, Jessen, and Tracy Smith, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second oral argument of the morning. It is June 16th, 2021, and we're conducting oral arguments via Zoom.gov, as you all are well aware. Thank you for joining us in this fashion. The second case of the morning is A21-0164 in the matter of the petition of Jane Serrano and Lynn Barbo for certain relief related to lands lying within St. Louis County, Minnesota. As you would in our physical courtroom, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument. I'd ask you to, each time you start an argument, to please state your name, because we do record these arguments and make them available on our website. And counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you have any technical troubles during the argument, let us know, or if any of us freeze or you're having trouble, because we want to stop the clock to make sure that we're able to hear your complete argument. You will notice that there is a timer keeping track of your time in one corner of our Zoom box this morning. So that should help us all adjust. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Steinhoff. I'm the attorney for appellants. Appellants are sisters. This appeal arises from an inheritance dispute with other siblings who are respondents relating to Torrens property. The facts are a little bit unusual, but they're straightforward. I say they're disputed in my brief, but I think a better way to say it is they're undisputed, but they're subject to some evidentiary objections because the facts involve a real estate transaction involving two persons who are deceased, the appellant's parents. So this relates to seasonal recreational property in St. Louis County on Lake Vermilion. It's part of a larger property that's been in this family for years with different family members owning different contiguous parcels. Appellants own their piece together as tenants in common. They had a mortgage on the property and they sought to refinance it. And they asked their parents, now deceased, to co-sign the loan documents. And the lender required the parents to have an interest in the property before it would allow that. So appellants drafted a deed to convey part of the property to their parents. At the suggestion of the father, they agreed that only 1% of the property would be conveyed. So father wrote 1% on the deed, but he put it up by the address and the parcel ID number on the second page.
Mr. Steinhoff?
Yes, yes, sir.
Can I interrupt you? I'm aware of the facts. I have a question about your position on the law. Your brief argues that that either of two of the exceptions in 508.71 applies, and you point to paragraphs 3 and 7. I noticed in the district court's analysis, the district court said, petitioners support the reformation theory on subdivision 2.3, and the district court doesn't mention 7. Is this a new argument as to paragraph 7, or was it always in the district court and the district court just overlooked it?
Your Honor, I don't know that the district court proceedings ever reached the question of which subpart of subparagraph 2 this falls under. I mean, I think subparagraph 3, any error or omission made in the certificate of title definitely applies, and that was acknowledged by the district court. I think 7 is a catch-all that would also apply, but I don't think it was specifically argued to the district court. No, Your Honor.
Just so I'm clear then, the reliance on paragraph 7 is new only in the Court of Appeals.
I think so, Your Honor, but I think the district court decided the case on a threshold legal issue without reaching the particulars of whether alteration of the certificate of title was allowed under any of these subparagraphs, if that answers your question.
So if I can follow up, sure. Looking at subdivision 2 of 508.71, I mean, it seems to me, and tell me if you think I'm wrong about this, that a lot of this case comes down to the, in some ways, the disconnect, or maybe not, between the first part of that subdivision and then the last part. I mean, the part that starts, the provisions in this section should not be given, give the court authority. I mean, if that were deleted, I mean, it would be clear, you know, I think your clients, you know, should have gotten some sort of hearing on the question they raised. But then you get to the second part and it's like, but it doesn't give the court authority to alter it if, and then those two provisions. So my question is, does this come down to whether the second portion of subdivision 2, oh, but you can't impair the title or right or purchasers, you know, or folks in value and good faith, even if one of the first seven subdivisions applies? I guess I'm trying to ask is, do you get a hearing under one of the first subdivisions on the issue of whether the order will impair the title or other interest of a purchaser? Or does that basically, that threshold mean you don't get the hearing at all? Do you see what I'm saying, Mr. Steinhoff? I'm just trying to figure out how to read this subdivision.
Your Honor, I think you have to get past the second part to get to the first part. So that the second part basically says you can't impair the interests of a bona fide or good faith purchaser for value without that person's consent. And you know, if that's what you're dealing with, then you don't get to the first part of the statute. So what the district court decided was that father who received his wife's interest after she died, that he was a good faith purchaser for value, and that the district court wasn't allowed to impair his title. So the district court never evaluated whether alteration of the certificate of title was allowed in the first place under the first part of the statute.
Just so I'm clear, if the district court was wrong about that, then you still would have to overcome, it looks like, you still have to establish that that paragraph 3 applies, since you didn't argue paragraph 7.
Your Honor, if the court were to reverse the district court on the threshold legal issue, I think it would have to be remanded back to the district court, and the district court would have to consider subparagraph 3. He'd also have to decide the evidentiary issues concerning whether this evidence of the true terms of the transactions is admissible, which he didn't do.
That's assuming that if we disagreed with your argument as to paragraph 3, we could affirm on that ground without getting to the question of good faith purchaser, right?
I hadn't thought about that, Your Honor. I think that should be something the district court should decide.
Right, but if it's a matter of law and we could decide it, if in fact, I'm not saying we'd go one way or the other, I'm just providing a hypothetical for you. If we disagreed with your argument that paragraph 3, as a matter of law, would allow you to survive summary judgment, then we wouldn't necessarily have to address the question of whether father was a purchaser in good faith.
I think you're correct, Your Honor, if you were to decide that the statutory relief wasn't available, even if father was not a good faith purchaser.
So I have a couple of questions about that. The first one, I guess, is just theoretical since it may not apply, but I'm wondering whether paragraphs 1 through 6 matter at all in the statute. Now that the legislature added paragraph 7, it seems like you could delete 1 through 6 since it's any time for any cause. The court should I haven't understood, again, it's not an issue, I suppose, in this case, because it wasn't argued to the district court, but it seems that that catch-all provision is more than a catch-all provision. It simply evaporates the other six as being unnecessary. Well, you don't have to struggle with that. I don't want you to spend your time. I do have one other question that's significant, though, on your brief. You yes, argue sir. That father made it was a purchaser. He provided consideration for only 1%, but not the rest. So as I sort of grapple with the idea of consideration, as we all learned in law school, consideration is just a peppercorn. You just need some consideration. I'm trying to get a sense of why whatever consideration father provided for that 1% wouldn't also supply consideration for the rest.
Your Honor, my response to that is that it wasn't intentional. It was inadvertent. So they made a deal of 1% in exchange for the signature. And then by mistake, what got conveyed was 50%.
So it's really not about consideration. It's just strictly an error.
Well, I think because it was an error, it's not consideration at all. So, I mean, there's all these cases about the sufficiency of the consideration. So if the parties actually agreed to something, and I was asking the court to say that what they agreed to doesn't support what they got back in return, then you'd be right. Courts aren't supposed to look at that. But here, and I think the pertinent case is E.J. Bear versus Pennotex Oil Corp, that if it wasn't intentional, it was a mistake, it's not consideration at all. So that takes it out of that line of cases and would allow you to decide that he wasn't a purchaser for value because this was inadvertent.
So if I may ask a question, Mr. Steinhoff, you make the point in your brief that the court can consider equity here. You know, and the district court said, no, this I can't. And you point to the cases about Collier and In Re Mortgage Electric Registration System. So where does equity come into play? Is it when the court looks at the second part of the subdivision, but as you pointed out, the first part of the analysis, you know, did the purchaser hold a certificate of title for value in good faith or the without written consent part, or does the equity come into play in looking at number three, any error or omission, or both? And whatever authority you have for that, let me know.
Your Honor, I think the core question here isn't an equitable one. It's you know, is father a good faith purchaser? And that's a very well-defined term that goes back 100 years. You can't be a good faith purchaser, if you have actual knowledge. And here, it was his idea. He knew what the terms of this transaction were supposed to be. He knew that the certificate of title didn't say what it was supposed to say. So he can't be a good faith purchaser because he had actual knowledge. I think the equitable consideration comes in. This is not a situation that the Torrens system was implemented to protect. I mean, we're supposed to be protecting people who buy property without knowledge of things that don't show up in the public land title records, that don't show up in the certificate of title. And that's not the situation here. Here we have a participant in the transaction who knew that he had given his signature in exchange for a 1% interest in this property. It was his idea. He's the one who made the notations on the deed.
Just so I'm clear on this argument that that Torrens is not intended to cover the circumstance here where the purchaser is the one asserting the need to modify, right? That's just, you're basing that just on just a logical inference from the statute. There's no case law that expressly holds that, is there?
Your Honor, there's a lot of case law on the phrase good faith purchaser for value, but none of it comes from this statute. It all comes up through the Recording Act, which is 50734, or the Torrens equivalent of the Recording Act, which is 50825. That this might be the first appellate case in which the phrase is interpreted as part of a petition to alter a certificate of title.
Right, but just so I'm clear, the argument that you're asserting that this just doesn't, that the statute really doesn't apply to the circumstance because of the relationship between father and the sellers, the appellants, for that 1% or whatever was purchased here, that theory is based upon your logical inference from the statute, not from any express statement in the statute or any case law stating so.
No, Your Honor, I think it's based on how the phrase good faith purchaser for value has been interpreted by the courts to mean to exclude somebody who has actual knowledge of an unregistered interest. So here we have an unregistered interest, which would be my client's claim to own 49% of this property that's not registered because it's not shown on the certificate of title. And the person who received the certificate of title has actual knowledge of that interest. So I am applying a definition that has been developed by the appellate courts and to the facts of this case. It's not so much the relationship between the parties, it's the knowledge that father had, which, I mean, he had to have had because he was a participant in the transaction. So, you know, he's not a third party who just happened to know about this. He actually agreed to it. My time is up. I'm happy to answer any more questions. Otherwise, I'll sit down.
I think I don't see any more questions in the panel. You have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, we'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Paul Kilgore representing the respondents. May it please the court, counsel. The question before the court is a question of law. Are claims based on extrinsic evidence capable of overturning a Torrens certificate of title that on its face rejects those claims? The appellants are claiming a collective 99.5% interest in the property, but the certificate and its memorials provide that appellants own a collective 75% interest in the property.
So, Mr. Kilgore, if I may, doesn't your original premise run right into the Collier case where I think there the bank held an interest that wasn't mentioned on the certificate of title?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of that question.
I apologize. Let me speak up. Doesn't that premise of your argument, it's a question of law, doesn't that run straight into the Collier case where the bank, as I recall the case, held an interest that wasn't mentioned on the certificate of title?
I think the Collier case comes into play here to address the exception under 50871 about a good faith purchaser for value. I think that the facts of Collier make it completely inapplicable to the fact situation here. We talk about that in our brief. So I believe that the statute makes it a question of law, not a question of fact.
Let's assume for a minute that we're completely ignorant of the law and we're just looking at this case and we just wanted to do what was fair. Can you give me a one sentence explanation as to why your clients should receive what your clients are seeking in this litigation as a matter of equity and fairness? I know your argument is that equity doesn't really apply here, but I'm just trying to get a sense of how it would feel good going to bed at night, feeling like giving your clients what it looks like to me might be a windfall.
Your Honor, the evidence that the appellants are relying on are writings that are not contemporaneous with the transfer that occurred months later. They occurred after the certificate was issued. I think here the equitable issue that should
Let's just assume that the email that father was representing a real desire to help his kids get a loan and wanted to do so in the most minimal fashion, knowing that he had to be owner and that he came up with the idea of 1% ownership. Let's assume that for the sake of my hypothetical question.
Well, that would be a hypothetical that I think there's no evidence for that in the record at all.
Yeah, well, let's just run with it as if we think there is some evidence of it. What would be the equitable position of your clients? What would justify your clients' stake in the property as asserted in the litigation?
Well, I think the harm would be not only to my clients, but I think the entire system would break down. If we can no longer rely on a certificate of title, as the Supreme Court said in Hirsch that we must, then simply the torrent system isn't any different than the abstract system, and the will of the legislature has been thwarted.
Hey, Counsel, this is what I was wondering. How did the father rely on the certificate? He didn't. I mean, that gets to the question of what that's all about, right? It's the next purchaser who would rely on their certificate, and that's what's important. How did father rely on their certificate? He didn't. It didn't exist yet, right?
Well, the statute specifically says that it's not only father, but father's heirs who are entitled to rely on that language in the statute. And my clients, the respondents, are the heirs.
But in other words, they have the interest that father had. But father didn't get this in reliance on Torrens, on the certificate. I think that's the problem. I mean, that's what I see as the equitable issue here. It's different from the system making sure that other people looking at it, you know, that they can purchase in good faith and that their interest won't be disrupted later by something they just didn't know. But here, if there's evidence, if there's a disputed fact that father in fact knew, he was not relying on a certificate. I mean, it's hard to see. And maybe you're just saying there's simply, well, I don't know what you're saying exactly. I might be misunderstanding. Are you saying there's no disputed fact about whether he in fact intended to or knew about the 1% issue, or are you saying, I think you're saying more, it doesn't matter because you don't get to challenge that?
I'm saying it doesn't matter. I would point out that in Torrens, the real estate interest is created with the certificate of title. So that's the reliance on the certificate of title as created by the registrar.
Who's reliance when you say that's reliance?
All of the owners and everyone looking at the certificate and claiming an interest in the property. That's the only place to look to see who actually owns the property and what interest that person has in the property. Everyone in the system relies on that certificate. And I think just to expand on that a little bit.
But if there is a mistake, I mean, we know that if there's a mistake or other reasonable ground, alteration can be made. Right. And you're saying, well, you can't get there because that would impair the purchaser, good faith purchaser's rights.
That's correct.
But at the time of the purchase, was it good faith if the person knew that there was another interest?
I think the entire good faith analysis that the appellants are arguing is misplaced. Appellants are claiming that the father categorically could not have been a purchaser in good faith because he was a participant in the transaction. And I'm not sure exactly what that means, but if we take that on its face, it means that no purchaser could ever be a purchaser in good faith, which is obviously an absurdity. In Recollier...
No. The purchaser could be a purchaser in good faith if the purchaser is relying upon the certificate. And I think that's what the statute means. Why is that not so?
Well, yes, but the appellants are arguing the purchaser could never be a purchaser in good faith by virtue of being part of the transaction. And, you know, what Collier talks about is a very different situation. You know, in Collier, we had three parties. We had A, who was the borrower. We had B, the bank that foreclosed on the borrower. And then we had C, who received a deed from A. And the question was, is C a purchaser in good faith? And we have nothing like that here. The appellants are A, the parents are B, and there is no C. Appellants are claiming, well, we're both A and C. But that's a dubious proposition. And even if we accept that, then they obviously have notice of the conveyance to B. And so they can't prevail on that argument either. So I think they're really using a theory that's meant to deal with three separate parties, and they're trying to shoehorn it in where there's only two parties here.
So if I, so the grounds for, the grounds for amending the certificate, you would agree that there are grounds that exist, right?
Correct.
Okay. And if those grounds exist and a purchaser in the father's position, let's say, you know, it's going to the registrar with a mistake that the person knows about, the purchaser knows about. Are you saying you couldn't win there, right? On summary judgment under your theory, a purchaser who purchases knowing that there's about to be a mistake issued in a certificate. Does the statute bar reformation of it there?
The statute does not.
Okay.
If someone acquires title, knowing that they're acquiring title from someone who actually doesn't own that property, the statute would provide a remedy for that. You would not have a good faith purchaser situation in that hypothetical.
So if the purchaser knows that a certificate is going to issue that says that they own 50% as opposed to 1%, if they know that, there can be no reformation later of that certificate. Is that what this case is about? That the purchaser knew that they were only going to get 50%. Let's just assume that they knew, even take it a step further, that it was going to issue with that mistake, that they would get 50% as opposed to 1%. There can be no reformation of it?
That's not what this case is about. And I say that because we know that looking to the pleadings filed by the appellants in this case. They don't even allege that the 1% notation existed on the deed at the time it was signed and delivered. Their pleading is simply that happened at closing, but that's not good enough. Even if we take every fact that they allege, it's not good enough to say that this notation occurred on the deed, an otherwise fully capable deed of integrity, that this notation occurred at closing. They have to allege it was there as of the moment of conveyance.
You say it's different. I mean, I'm positing that the person knows that they're about to get, they know they're only purchasing 1% and the deed's going to issue with, and a deed issues with 50% or the certificate of title, whatever deed. Sorry if my lingo is wrong there. So you're saying it's not this case because why? I mean, you're giving me some evidence about it's not at closing, et cetera, but what's different? Like if the purchaser knows they're about to get something that they are not in fact purchasing, that the title's going to show that they have something that they didn't in fact purchase. Is that what's not here about that, at least as a disputed fact?
Yeah, there is no genuine issue of fact that would support that interpretation of this. The only facts that are being alleged by appellants is we have this writing on the deed. Otherwise, there'd be no case at all. And we have months later, after the certificate's issued, we've got some extemporaneous email.
Who made the writing on the deed?
Well, we don't know that. I heard Mr. Steinhoff say that it was made by the father today. I don't know that in the record we have any evidence of who did it.
Okay, so that is not, you're saying as a matter of law it wasn't? I'm just wondering if that writing on the deed shows father's knowledge that he was purchasing 1%.
I'm saying as a threshold issue, you have to at least plead that that's the case. Your pleadings have to state, at the time the deed was delivered, it stated 1% on it. They don't do that. What they say
Why is that so? Why is that so? What if the evidence shows that father was not a purchaser in good faith of 50%? Why would it matter whether it was on the deed itself or it occurred? Let's say it was a conversation that happened later that was recorded where dad says, I knew I was, you know, I really pulled one over on them. We had agreed to only 1%, but but now we've got 50%. Why would it have to be on the deed in order to create a potential fact dispute as to whether he was a purchaser in good faith?
Well, because I think then you just undo the Torrens statute if you allow in evidence when you've got a deed without on its in its four corners, no suggestion of anything other than what's stated in the deed. If you can later go back and attack the certificate, you're basically allowing any title to be reopened.
Well, the problem I have with your argument is the legislature's decision to add paragraph 7. Upon any reasonable ground, that any other alteration or adjudication should be made, any reasonable ground. And it seems like the legislature was intending to avoid the kind of strict application that you're asking us to apply to the statute.
And I would respond to that by pointing to the second part of subdivision 2, the sentence that begins the provisions of this section, and then goes on and talks about the impairment issue. So I think you have to satisfy that threshold before you even get to any of the seven subdivisions above.
But it seems like you don't think that one can ever prove factually that there was a lack of good faith. You think that would undermine the system. And that good faith, I think, is where we get at what the person knew.
I think that's a misapplication of the doctrine of good faith. I think what good
faith... So what does good faith mean? That would be helpful. Okay.
Okay. Good faith, the father would not be a purchaser in good faith if he knew that by taking this property, it was actually titled in someone else's name, not in the name of the grantors, and that by taking title, he was depriving some third party of an interest. But there is no third party in this case. I wanted to, in my time remaining, I wanted to point to one more thing, and that is the language of the appellant's counter petition, which is in their addendum at AA19. And here's the relief they're asking for. And I'm quoting from paragraph 9. Assuming that the court does not find that the quitclaim deed dated February 21 transfers only a 1% interest, then appellants alternatively plead and allege that the deed reflects the ownership of the parents as a 1/3 issue interest, a 1/3 interest.
Gore, you need to wrap up in a couple of sentences here.
Okay, thank you. What this suggests is that what's involved here is some remorse, some horse trading. All of these things are anathema to the Torrens Act. And so I would ask that the district court decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Steinhoff, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to, first of all, push back on the idea that there has to be a third party involved for a good faith purchaser issue to arise. That's what usually happens in these cases. There's a third party who buys the property and does or doesn't know about some prior transaction, but there's no reason why it can't involve just two parties, because one of them is actually a party to the transaction that created the unregistered interest. There's no basis in the case law for that kind of limitation.
So is this basically that the parties could dispute what the contract meant, even though there's a certificate of title that has issued? You know, oh, that's not what I meant to buy. I meant to buy something else. That seems to run contrary to what this is about.
I mean, the way I would view it is father receives the certificate of title and he knows that he agreed to something different. So he knows, he has actual knowledge of the interest that they agreed to convey. So he didn't receive the certificate of title as a good faith purchaser because he has actual knowledge of what the actual terms were.
So does that require then to analyze then the district court? Do you get into what the contract for purchase meant then? Is that when you get into what the issue is around?
I think it does, Your Honor. And I think to get to Judge Ross's point, does it have to be written on the deed? I think it does under the statute of frauds. I think the statute of frauds would require the deed to actually have in writing what the term in question is, which it does. So if this were a verbal agreement for 1%, like Judge Ross inquired about it, that wouldn't satisfy the statute of frauds. It has to be actually written on the deed, which it is. So
so you look at the deed, and then there's a question around the extrinsic. You're saying that's enough because it reflects it, and so you don't need extrinsic evidence beyond that? Or what
no,
about
the- I mean, I think you need extrinsic evidence because the deed, the writing is ambiguous because it, you know, the 1% is written in a different place than I would have put it, or most everybody else in the real estate industry would have put it. So I think extrinsic evidence is admissible under the parole evidence rule to interpret this document. But it's a written document that satisfies the statute of frauds. I think it qualifies under the parole evidence rule for extrinsic evidence to come in. And I think the extrinsic evidence out there is pretty overwhelming about what the parties actually intended here. Going back to the equitable argument, I can't think of a single reason why it would be fair for respondents to prevail in this action. I mean, it would be grossly unfair for them to get all this property when their parents obviously didn't intend it to go to them.
In response to Mr. Kilgore's argument that none of the writings asserted in the case as evidence was contemporaneous with the transaction.
Well, we have affidavits from my client. They were there. So we have affidavits based on their personal knowledge. We have a will addendum written by father and mother that characterized the interest as a 1% interest. That was obviously after the transaction, but I don't see why that's not admissible. I mean, if father was alive and he testified in court that I intended this deed to convey a 1% interest, that wouldn't be contemporaneous. But it would be admissible. He's deceased, so we're looking at his writings. And we have two writings that are not contemporaneous, but they're admissible as statements against interest, at the very least, that both characterize his interest as a 1% interest. I see no reason why they would have to be contemporaneous with the transaction.
Is there any contemporaneous writing?
Just the deed itself, Your Honor. I mean, there's the deed, and then there's two post-transaction writings, and then there's affidavits from my client who were there. So that's the body of evidence that's in the record. I have 5 seconds. I will answer any more questions.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
You may, Judge Ross.
Is the writing on the deed sufficient, or would you also need the other evidence, the affidavit testimony and the will?
I think if you would consider the deed to be unambiguous, such that it's unambiguous that it conveys 1%.
Well, let's assume that it's not unambiguous that it conveys 1%. I think that would be that's a pretty far stretch to say that it's unambiguous with that writing.
So I think the extrinsic evidence is necessary to prove what the deed means, because it's susceptible to more than one interpretation. So you need parole evidence in order to interpret it.
Just so we're clear, you were just saying hypothetically whether it was unambiguous, but you're not making the argument, are you, that the notation by the father could be treated as unambiguous as to his own.
No, Your Honor, I would not make that argument, and I didn't in my brief. I acknowledged that it was ambiguous.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your helpful arguments and briefing. The court will take this matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the next 90 days. And with that, we're at the end of our oral arguments for this morning, and the court is in recess.